From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Oregon has it. Washington State has it. California, Maine, Hawaii have had a push for it. On November 6th, Massachusetts will vote on a Death with Dignity Act, the right to die, physician-assisted suicide. Not hands-on, not an injection, but like Washington and Oregon, a prescription that would let patients facing a difficult death take their own lives. This hour on Point, we look at how far the law should go in letting, helping people to end their lives. You can join the conversation. Do you cringe at the thought of physician-assisted suicide for the terminally ill or not? Do you wish the option were available in your state to you? What's your family's end-of-life story? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We will check in first today in Oregon, where a Death with Dignity Act was implemented in 1997. They've got a lot of experience with this now. Then we'll hear pro and con views from Massachusetts, where voters will become the latest to decide on November 6th, Election Day. Joining me now from Portland, Oregon, is Barbara Coombs Lee, president of Compassion and Choices. It is an advocacy group which looks at end-of-life issues and has fought to expand the Death with Dignity Act beyond Oregon. She was chief petitioner for Oregon's Death with Dignity Act. She practiced as a nurse and physician's assistant for 25 years. Joins us from Portland. Barbara Coombs Lee, thank you very much for being here.
I'm happy to be here, Tom. Thank you.
So we know, and right up front, you're in this on kind of a mission. You pushed for this in the first place. You're an advocate of it. Give us the facts on how it's worked out in Washington. How long has this, in Oregon, how long has it actually been going on now, Barbara, and how's it being used?
It's been going on, as you said, since the waning months of 1997. The statistics started to be gathered at the beginning of 1998. So mm-hmm. We have almost 15 years of experience here in Oregon. You're right. I'm an advocate. When I talk about the Oregon experience, though, I usually point to people who are not advocates, who have made a study of the data, and the data coming out of Oregon is voluminous. Researchers, investigative teams from the Veterans Hospital, from Oregon Health and Science University, from the University of Washington have studied the experience in depth from every aspect. And what I do is point to the findings of those people, people like the Government Accounting Office, people like courts in Canada, people like the AG in Vermont had a special task force, who don't have any skin in the game, who are not advocates, and examine this voluminous body of data. And their conclusion is, this has been a good thing for dying patients in Oregon. It's been a good thing for end-of-life care.
Can you walk us through, Barbara, exactly what the Oregon law, and I guess Washington's pretty similar, I think Massachusetts is just about the same, what it makes possible? What actually does it say? What does it legalize?
It's almost identical to the law in Oregon and Washington, and actually a similar rights are in place in Montana as well by a Montana Supreme Court ruling. But what it allows is for a terminally ill person, a person who within reasonable medical judgment is likely to die within 6 months, the same criteria for admission to hospice, a person who is terminally ill and mentally competent, they are decisionally capable, can ask their physician for medication that they could take at a time and a place of their own choosing if they found their suffering to be unbearable.
Medication that would what?
Medication that would cause their death.
What are we talking about? Barbiturates here? What is it generally? Barbiturates? Is there
the usual medication is a short-acting barbiturate, yes.
Mm-hmm. Is it these might be very ill people. Do they have to choke down dozens and dozens of pills, or how does it work?
Well, even if it's in pill form, it's dissolved in liquid, and so it's it's not something to choke down. Mm-hmm. It's about 4 ounces of fluid.
Okay, so it's something that a patient would drink. The doctor prescribes this. That's legal under this law if it meets the criteria. And how often is this happening? How many people have done it? How many people are doing it every year?
About 1 in 500 deaths in Oregon are by aid in dying. That means a total of 596 people over the first 14 years. It's interesting to note, and very important, that a great many more people go through the process of eligibility and obtain either the prescription or even fill the prescription and obtain the medication. And, you know, they do it for comfort, Tom. They do it for peace of mind. They don't want to take the medication. They want to have it.
Just in case it becomes unbearable to them.
Exactly, exactly. And so every year, between 30, one year, 51% of the people who obtained the medication didn't take it. They leave it under their pillow. They call it their parachute, their insurance policy, their safety blanket. It's enormously important for people facing the end of life to feel, for some people, the people who make this request, to feel an element of control, to feel as though they won't be stuck in their worst nightmare and unbearable suffering.
What do the numbers show about what kind of ailments these people who request the drugs tend to have, those who use the death potion tend to have? What are they up against?
Overwhelmingly, Tom, this is about people who are dying of cancer. 85%, I think, of the people who have made a request and ingested their medication are dying of cancer. The next most common diagnosis is ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, Lou Gehrig's disease, which is, if you compare it to the incidence of that disease in the population, it's way disproportionate. So people dying of ALS are more likely to be interested in aid in dying. Than any other illness.
Now you say they have to be determined to be terminally ill, or that is that they're headed to die within 6 months. How truly knowable is that?
Well, of course, it's not completely knowable, but we've used that measure for years and years as a measure for hospice admission, and it is quite reliable. The studies show that when physicians make that kind of prognostication, overwhelmingly, they tend to overestimate, not underestimate, the likely lifespan.
Do doctors now, have to give this prescription if they're asked for it, or can they opt out?
Say, no. No one has to do anything that they don't want to do. Mm-hmm. And so there are physicians who might have conscientious objection, and that's perfectly fine. Well, we do suggest that patients should find that out about their physician, relatively soon in the course of the illness so that they don't get trapped.
Mm-hmm.
It's important to be cared for by a physician who shares your values and beliefs find at the end.
Your fellow Oregonian, Barbara Glidewell, at the Oregon Health and Science University was quoted saying that back in the beginning there was a fear that the elderly would be lined up in their RVs at the Oregon border, sort of, you know, flooding into Oregon to die with dignity or have this option for assisted suicide. What about that? Have people moved to Oregon in big numbers to have this option?
Well, the numbers are so infinitesimally small that, there's nothing that has to do with big numbers here. And, this is for Oregon residents. This is for people who are established in Oregon. The family is here. The physician is here. It's conceivable someone could move to Oregon, but, when you're terminally ill, you don't have very much energy for that. So, this is for people who are established residents of Oregon.
You've had uncomfortable moments. There was one, I think, when a woman was up against a tough disease and she got a notice of her options that included, didn't give her the medicine she wanted, but included the option of assisted suicide. That's being used in the debate over this in Massachusetts right now. Here's a little bit from a video released on September 18th by an advocacy group called Second Thoughts, which is against this. Here's the voice of the woman.
They would pay to kill me, but they will not give me the medication to try to stop the growth of my cancer.
Barbara Coomsley, that sounds pretty terrible. That's out of Oregon. What about that? Has there been any tendency to offer less medical treatment and, more, here's death's door for you?
Poor Barbara Wagner, that's the name of that woman, she was facing a very, very difficult illness, and she was in the last stage of her terminal illness, and she was eligible for hospice care. Her physician recommended a treatment that, you can't really call it a treatment because it had virtually no chance of improving the quality of her life or lengthening it. And she was on Medicaid. She was her care was paid for by public funds. And yes, she received a letter saying that this medication is considered experimental, and that's
that was
not
the
covered.
Cancer therapy, and so they didn't support it. They didn't pay
well,
for
right.
it.
Well, I mean, right. But as I said, it's kind of a misnomer to call it therapy
okay.
because and actually her kind of cancer since that time. There have been studies that show that she would have lived longer. She did end up getting this medication the pharmaceutical house provided. She would have lived longer if she had refused it, if she had just accepted palliative care. She rejected all of that. She rejected palliative care. She rejected hospice. That would have been the best for her. But she was persuaded that this long shot was her best option, and clearly it was not. She
Barbara,
died soon afterwards.
There's also the fear that the death option would be taken by folks who are running out of money and can't afford care, and so the poor would disproportionately go for, you know, the right to die.
That hasn't really played out. All the people, virtually all, are insured. The people who are not insured and are not on the state Medicaid system are essentially self-insured. You know, they're wealthy enough to be able to pay for their own care. So it's really not the case that anyone makes this decision on the basis of financial concerns. The concerns are loss of autonomy, loss of the quality of life, loss of the ability to do and think and do everything that means a meaningful life to these people.
Barbara Coombs Lee in Portland, Oregon, with Compassion and Choices. Barbara, thank you very much for being with us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the right to die, death with dignity, assisted suicide. 15 years in Oregon now. It's there, the law in Washington State. Now on the ballot in Massachusetts on November 6th. With me right now in the studio, Ed Lowenstein is professor of anesthesia, professor of medical ethics at Harvard Medical School, provost of the Department of Anesthesia and Critical Care at Massachusetts General Hospital. He was one of 14 signatories to the original petition to introduce the Death with Dignity Act to the ballot, question 2 in Massachusetts. Ed Lowenstein, thank you very much for being with us today.
Yes, thank you.
It's good to have you here. And with us in the studio, Michael Grodin, professor of health law, bioethics, and human rights at Boston University's School of Public Health, psychiatrist, medical ethicist at Boston Medical Center, where he's consulted on more than 1,500 cases, about half involving end-of-life issues. Michael Grodin, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Let's get some of our listeners in here, and then we'll come to your views on what one state is looking at right now. Beth in Charleston, South Carolina. Beth, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I definitely believe in physician-assisted suicide. I think that death with dignity is a great way to explain it. I watched my grandmother on hospice just starving and thirsting to death, and I do not think that that is okay. I think if people want to choose to die, I mean, terminally ill people, of course, they should have that option. I mean, this is the land of the free. And we need to protect that right. Not that it exists yet, but...
Beth, let me ask you, even in the land of the free, there are things that are out of bounds, things that are just considered immoral. Does this cheapen life somehow? Does it cheapen life to open this exit door?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, it's much worse to watch a loved one suffer than for them to be able to choose, you know, a dignified way to die. I mean... I don't understand why people don't support it already when it's their own life. I mean, you should have control over your own life.
Beth, and death, you're saying. Beth, we've got it. One more. Dana in Charlotte, North Carolina. Dana, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. The legal debate on this issue has baffled me based on my experience, which was about 7 years ago when my father was dying of cancer in Arizona. And you know, he was on hospice in the last 3 days. The 3 days before he died, the nurses basically gave us the orders of how we were supposed to administer the morphine until he died. And I asked, I said, so we're basically overdosing him? And they said, yes, this is a very reputable cancer hospital where these nurses came from. It wasn't legal in the state, but it's what is actually happening for many cancer patients already. So it just confuses me about why it's actually a debate. I mean, we know that that's what's happening. We're not letting many of our cancer patients just wait out the cancer.
But off the books, maybe going on in different ways already. Dana, thanks for that. And one more, we'll go to our guest Jocelyn in Littleton, Massachusetts. Jocelyn, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I am, in support of the medication being available. I think what concerns me is teenagers, having access to medication like this. I know it's prescription, but they're pretty crafty. And if motivated enough to commit suicide, they could probably get their hands on it. And I'll take the response off the air.
You're worried just about having more barbiturates sort of out in circulation. And, of course, we all know that sort of medicine chest problem is out there, though presumably something like this people would take really close care of. Let's go to Ed and Michael Groden. Ed Lowenstein, you favor this. You helped get it on the ballot in Massachusetts. You've seen a lot of medical care over the year and no doubt no small amount of death. Why do you favor it, Ed?
Well, Tom, in the United States, we are privileged to enjoy self-determination. We permit people to live their lives as long as they choose, as long as they don't harm others.
But suicide's against the law.
Actually, suicide is not against the law in any state.
Really?
But that is correct. It was in the past, but it no longer is. But there's simply no reason to take away the privilege for people to live their lives as they choose as they are approaching the inevitable end of their lives. Now, the people who take advantage of this don't have a choice. They, in fact, are dying.
So they are going to die, but they have a choice about how and the pace.
They have a choice about the manner and timing of their deaths. They have a choice of alleviating their suffering if they wish, but only if they wish. There is absolutely no this is all completely voluntary.
What do you say to those, Ed, who say, and the Catholic Church has been prominent among opponents to this nationally and in Massachusetts, that there is sanctity to life and that this is something that should take its own course. This is something that should be beyond human intervention, even if you respect self-determination.
Yes, I think that's extremely worth talking about. This issue, as Barbara has presented to you the experience in Oregon, it's just about 15 years. And on the basis of that experience, this issue turns out to be simple rather than complex for those who don't base their opinion on a faith-based belief that only a higher power should decide the timing of life or death. And those people, I think they are entitled to their views. They're entitled to use that. There's absolutely no coercion in this, and they should be allowed to have that. However, at least in my opinion and the opinion of many others, that does not mean that they should prevent others who believe the opposite from the way they do. And that's one of the hallmarks of this country, is that we respect the views of others.
Let's listen to an ad. This is put out by the Committee Against Physician-Assisted Suicide. It's got the backing of the Catholic Church and other groups. It has this ad up running in Massachusetts. Now, it shows capsules of the barbiturate secanol being counted on a pharmacist's tray with a voiceover from doctors, apparently, who oppose physician-assisted suicide.
Here's what's wrong with question two. It applies to people who've been given a prognosis of 6 months or less to live, but no doctor ever knows for sure. We give our best estimate, but you should never make a life or death decision based on someone's guess.
Here's another big problem. A patient doesn't commit suicide in a medical setting. They receive a prescription for a powerful narcotic called secanol, and they fill it at their local pharmacy.
Then they take it home and ingest up to 100 capsules to end their life. There's no doctor present and no family notification required.
That's not death with dignity.
That's dangerous,
irresponsible,
and completely out of control.
There's the ad from those opposed in the Massachusetts case to what's question two on November 6th in Massachusetts. Death with dignity, supporters call it. And here you can see they're not in favor of it at all. Michael Grodin, does that capture some of your objections to it, or why are you opposed to this law?
Well, first of all, I want to say up front that death and dying and physician-assisted suicide is a very difficult topic, and it's supposed to be a difficult topic.
Yes.
And I think what we're concerned about here is how people die. And my view is that physician-assisted suicide is a symptom of the problem, not the solution. It would be a tragedy if terminally ill patients were forced to choose physician-assisted suicide, for instance, because they lacked access to adequate health care. 44 million people have no health care. It would be a tragedy if they were forced to pick physician-assisted suicide because they lacked continuity in primary care of doctors who knew them, knew their worries and fears. If they didn't have access to palliative care and hospice care universally, it's unacceptable for patients to die in pain today, nor need they be in pain. So everybody should have access to pain relief. Everybody should have access to adequate mental health referrals, including evaluation of depression. And we know that many people who are dying are depressed and can be treated for their depression. The people need adequate social and family spiritual support. So I think it's very dangerous to have the notion of physician-assisted suicide in the absence of those protections for people. What we don't want is people killing themselves because they don't have access to health care.
Are you afraid that that would happen, that because we don't have good enough medical care, people would opt for an earlier death?
Well, the physician-assisted suicide advocates frame the problem as one of choice and autonomy, which we've already heard here in this discussion. But that's a misnomer, because without access to health care, without access to palliative care, without access to health care, there's no true choice. In fact, the law says that the physician must tell you what other alternatives there are available besides physician-assisted suicide. But there's no guarantee that those choices exist or that people have access to those choices.
Now, what we've heard coming out of Oregon, at least, it doesn't seem to reflect much of the kind of problem you're describing, unless I misunderstand. But it seems that that's not really what's happening there. What do you say to that?
Well, first of all, Massachusetts is not Oregon. And I'm quite
every state is different, in other words. So what's the difference that matters in this case?
I'm concerned that in Massachusetts, where we have a much more diverse socioeconomic group, I work at Boston Medical Center, where 60 people come from 60 countries. Our patients are not concerned about overtreatment. They're concerned about getting access to treatment, any kind of treatment. And so I'm concerned about how this would work in Massachusetts. I'm very concerned about this would be a diversion from good end-of-life care, which is really the key issue. And also, if you're dealing in a for-profit healthcare system where people constantly talk about too much money being spent on Medicare at the last 6 months of life. Of course, that's a misnomer because you're always going to spend more money when people are sick. But physician-assisted suicide costs about $300. And at the same time, in Oregon, Medicaid was cutting health care while they were adding lethal prescription to the list of treatments, quote unquote.
Michael, stand by. I want to put this, it's a big issue. Let me put it to Ed. What about it here? We know we have imperfect health care in this country. Is there a danger that if more states begin to adopt this, we'll see, you know, assisted suicide as being rolled out instead of care? Or, you know, there's a lot of for-profit health care in this country, for-profit insurance, $300 to have somebody, you know, die in a matter of minutes versus months and months of expensive care. You can see insurance companies could lean that way.
I think the exact opposite is true, Tom. This has been raised since before the law in Oregon was passed. And the opposite has occurred. The other thing that's happened in Oregon is that there has been a flowering of palliative care and of hospice care. It is perhaps the best in the United States. The pain treatment is about the best in the United States.
Why would there be a flowering of palliative care in a state in particular that has the right to die option available? Are you drawing a correlation somehow?
Well, this certainly has occurred in parallel.
So it doesn't preclude that, you're saying?
It absolutely does not. It encourages it. And one of the things that has happened with it is that it has brought this whole issue out of the closet. And so people feel empowered to talk with their physicians about their care.
Ed, what about Michael Grodin's point that you're going to have states with more diverse socioeconomic profiles and that you may have more people in some states who do not have good access to health care and therefore a greater danger of this being a kind of a low-cost option to full treatment?
I think this specter will continue to be raised. I do take Michael's point very, very seriously. The big problem in our country, we have a huge problem with access to medical care for about a sixth of our population. That is an important thing. But these are two completely unrelated issues.
Let's go to Judy in Somerville, Massachusetts. Judy, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm calling as the daughter of someone who was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis in 1977, and she mm-hmm. died in 1997.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched her from diagnosis to death suffer mightily. For the last 10 years of her life, she was bedridden. For about 8 of those years, she was on a feeding tube, and she had lost mobility.
Yeah.
She could really only move her eyes and her tongue. She had access to great care. She was very fortunate in that sense, but she also had an extraordinarily low quality of life.
Mm-hmm.
And I really support people's access to this option, and I wish that she had had this option. I don't know what she would have thought of it. I don't know if she had had access to it, if she would have taken advantage of it, but she suffered so profoundly, and she was in so much pain for almost a decade. And
that's a long time.
So
you look back and wish the option had been there. Judy, that's a moving story and a lot of time. It wasn't there for her, but there's all kinds of circumstances. Let us hold your story in mind for a moment. Let me go to thank you. Alan.
She wouldn't have been eligible for this because she was not terminally ill.
Do you agree, Ed?
That is absolutely correct, until she was terminally ill.
Oh, my gosh.
She would have been.
So what's the principle?
Let me just mention something.
Yes.
She would have been eligible to withdraw her feeding tube.
This law would make that legal, and it's not now, or she could in any case.
No, this is already a patient has self-determination, mm-hmm. and a patient cannot be forced to eat or drink. So she would have had that possibility. But this act would not address that particular thing until she was at the end of her life.
But this is part of the slippery slope.
Yes.
Because there's no principle distinction. And so why not let somebody who's paralyzed or unable to take the medicine, mm-hmm. or somebody who's in the process of a terminal of an illness, we're all terminal.
Yes,
and
of course.
Particularly without treatment.
Right.
And so the question is, there's no principle line here.
So you're saying if we permit it for those with 6 months to go, the next time around we may be talking to people with 6 years to go, no frontier, no boundary.
That's correct.
Ed?
There is absolutely and simply no evidence of a slippery slope in Oregon after 15 years. There's no reason to expect one.
Well, because it's illegal.
Right. But you're saying, Michael, you're thinking the society's overall moral sense or ethical sense or legal sense of what's possible may move over time.
As a physician who deals with people who are suicidal, people have existential angst, and that's the reason why they're suicidal. Our response to suicidal patients is not to provide them with medication or to help them kill themselves, but to try to deal with the psychosocial, spiritual, or whatever their problem is, to try to deal with that angst. These patients, by the way, kill themselves primarily because of concern of future loss of autonomy, dignity, and function. That's what the Aragon study
shows.
But this isn't something for
anybody who's feeling suicidal. It's for particular circumstances. I mean, the angst is kind of a fancy word. If you've got less than 6 months to go and you're in terrible pain and you're suffering.
So terminally ill patients should not be devalued in this situation any more than non-terminally ill patients or suicidal patients.
But what about their own will as they lie there in that pain?
So what I'm suggesting is there are things we can do, and our society has decided
to keep them alive.
No, to help deal with the existential suffering, to deal with the pain, to deal mm-hmm. with the psychosocial supports. The concern is that people who have used this have said that they're concerned about future loss of autonomy, dignity, and future function. And we can deal with those things.
Some may feel it in the moment as well, but we'll come back and look at that. Yes. Michael Grodin, I'm glad you're here. Ed Lowenstein. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the right to die, death with dignity, assisted suicide. 15 years in Oregon, the law in Washington State, now on the ballot to be voted on November 6th in Massachusetts. You can join the conversation with Michael Grodin, professor of health law, bioethics, and human rights at Boston University's School of Public Health, and Ed Lowenstein, a professor of anesthesia, medical ethics at Harvard Medical School, and more. And we are in the midst of a big conversation here. Ed, you were listening to Mike just before the break. Your thought there?
Yes, of course. The supporters of this bill agree with everything that Michael has said up to the conclusion. which is that sometimes this just does not work. It does not relieve people's unbearable suffering.
You mean palliative care?
Palliative care, the best medical care, mm-hmm. the best of everything we have to offer.
Mm-hmm.
Medical science, medical care is just not effective in everyone. And in those people, should they choose, they deserve to have this option. This is a small number of people, as Barbara Coombs Lee said. In Oregon, it's one in every 500 deaths.
So it's not like people have rushed to it.
That is absolutely correct.
And she said, I think half those who get the drugs, who have the dose from their doctor on hand in case they want to use it, don't use it.
Many people who get it don't use it.
Michael, what about the lack of a stampede or even a big volume in Oregon? What does that say to you?
One of the things that's quite disturbing about Oregon, in my view, is that one of the things that's part of the law is that if somebody comes to you and asks for a physician-assisted suicide,
if someone comes to a doctor,
right, there's supposed to be an assessment about their mental health status, and there's supposed to be a referral to a mental health provider to make an assessment about what their status is. And it's documented in Oregon that mental health referrals have only occurred in maybe one out of 350 patients who kill themselves. So this is a very disturbing when you consider...
Why? Because they're probably depressed?
That's because there's evidence that suggests that probably as high as 25% of people who are terminally ill who have depression that can be treated, can be treated with antidepressants, can be treated with psychosocial support systems.
Ed, what about it?
So this is a real problem.
We get it. Ed, what do you say to that?
This is an allegation which is made. There is just simply no evidence for it.
One out of 350 have been referred for psychological evaluation. Does that seem like too small a number, given that people surely facing death probably do feel depression? I mean, I don't know if that should stop them or not. But
people facing death may feel depressed, but the thing that is treatable is clinical depression. And I would argue that forcing people, coercing people to see a mental health professional at that time of their life is often very, very cruel.
People who are suicidal, that's our job, is to refer people for mental health.
But isn't it different if they're on the final slope toward death? It could be cruel to say, you know what, you're suffering, but let me tell you, because I'm your doctor or your psychiatrist, you're going to go off and have several months of treatment while you suffer.
For an evaluation of what their status is. And I think, again, terminally ill patients should not be devalued to suggest that they're less valuable than somebody who's not terminally ill
or
somebody who's suicidal.
Is that a kind of arrogance of the healthy to look at it that way? If they're saying, please, I'm done.
That is an arrogance of physicians, I would argue.
Well, you could also argue that it's a determination to save life and to
make sure people don't kill themselves, because there's preventable things that we can do for them. If we understand their psychosocial, spiritual, whatever those problems may be, that we can address those. And that's, in fact, what medicine does, is address these problems and these fears and the worries, the fear of loss of...
Absolutely.
The job of medicine is not to refer you for medication, but to refer you for care.
Well, Michael, we have agreed on that. These are people in whom that does not work. And you know this happens for you to think that our administrations can help all patients, all dying patients, is simply arrogance. And this should be about patients, not physicians.
Well, I mean, physicians do have a certain oath. We'll look at that. But I would also note, Michael, that when you say that what medicine about is caring for the psychosocial, spiritual life of patients, we all know that in many cases, even in very good medical circumstances, that does not happen. Even the spiritual care, I'm not sure.
And that's why this is a diversion for what we really need to focus on.
Maybe, but it sounds like you're describing some nirvana where everything's perfect and you've got perfect spiritual care. That would be nice.
But that's our goal. Our goal is to deal with how people how they are treated in their ends of life. And that's not very good. And so we need to focus on that rather than physician-assisted suicide.
I take the point. It's a strong point. Let me read some of the response we're getting online here. Skeptic writes, I believe the option should be available. If I were terminally ill and suffering, I would want the option. To deny people this option, this one listener writes, is barbaric and cruel. Cheryl writes, I watched my mother die a horrible death. Her last breaths were painful to watch and couldn't have been less painful to experience. 1 month later, I had to put down a beloved dog. And I was struck by the difference in the two deaths. My dog was allowed a swift and painless death with dignity that the system will not allow me when it's my time, she writes. Here's one from John Patrick Dwyer, Jr. My wife died after a 5-year struggle with cancer. I watched her slowly go from an active woman to something who was bedridden and in pain. John writes, she weighed only 60 pounds when she died. I promised her that I would not let her suffer. I'm a Vietnam vet, and death is no stranger to me, but I could not end her life, and that has haunted me for a long time. I just couldn't do it. We absolutely need help with this, John writes. Patricia says maybe one day this struggle will be used to save health care costs of the elderly by eliminating them. That's her fear. But what about John's lament there, that he couldn't give his wife what he wanted to, which in her case was a death?
What I can tell you is talking to my colleagues and in my own experience of helping deal in consultation with probably 1,000 patients, that the number of patients that we're dealing with is a handful. I can name on one hand one or two patients who have adequate health care, adequate palliative care, adequate hospice care, adequate mental health care, that those are the things that people need. And in those cases, we've dealt with the angst.
But only a handful
so
have all
make,
those
I
things?
I want to make it more difficult for people to commit suicide, not easier for people to commit suicide, insofar as we can do something for them. When, again, I don't want people to kill themselves because they don't have access to adequate ends-of-life care.
Ed, fix
and that
the healthcare
be the
system, optimize it, rather than crack open the door to an easier death.
We will still need that. This is not an easier death.
It is this not. Then what's the point?
Let me just think about the patients who are on the World Trade Center. On the roof.
Patients? Oh, you mean
the
people who were working there on the day of the attack?
That's correct.
Okay.
And they were on the roof, and there was a fire coming at them, and they jumped off the...
Some
did.
What's your point there?
Would you condemn them? Would you say they were committing suicide? Would you say no? They had no choice.
But the fire's coming for all of us. We're all terminals.
Their intent was not to die. Their intent was not to die.
So you're saying that if somebody
is
fiercely in the line of death and there's no escaping it and it's going to be horrible,
they can opt for this. They should be able to opt for this kind of a choice.
But what about take Michael's perfect world where we can optimize medical, psychosocial, spiritual care for every individual? Then would you back away from this?
No, because there still will be some people for whom this does not give them the type of comfort that they need. They are still suffering.
So even with your Hippocratic oath, it says, first do no harm.
Absolutely.
Are you expanding the meaning of that here somewhere?
No, I'm not. Under these circumstances, when a patient cannot be cured and their suffering cannot be relieved, they should have the option to relieve it in the way that
So why would you limit it to terminal ill patients? Why would you limit it to terminally ill patients, if according to your logic? If people are suffering and they want to kill themselves, why wouldn't you just
Because
give them
people suffer and want to kill themselves in many stages and many circumstances, Ed?
Michael, this, as you know, this is a very specific bill aimed for these people, and these are the people for whom we would want it.
I mean, Michael, you can hear also in the comments of our listeners that they do fear the circumstance.
Absolutely.
Of being trapped on that roof, World Trade Center.
That's the concern I have, that people come to the doctor with fear of the future. They're not suicidal at the time, at least in Oregon. What they are is fear of the future, and we can deal with that fear. We can deal with the fear of the losses that they're going to have. But, and so I think that's what we want to focus on.
I take your point, but it's interesting how you call this suicidal and sort of wrap it in with
suicidal self-murder.
Well, there again, you're wrapping in with anybody who does that. Ed is carving out, and I think it's he's making a distinction a lot of people will relate to. It doesn't seem like the same as a teen suicide, where they've got decades of life ahead of them and maybe healthy life. They're just depressed. Is that really fair to wrap all those together?
Well, that's why I'm suggesting we should treat all patients, not devalue any patient because they're incompetent or because they don't have
And yet there's something that I think there's a difference that people intuitively that the people intuit here about the end. But I take your point, Alan, Dennis, Massachusetts. Alan, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Very interesting subject. My son died recently at a major hospital in Massachusetts.
I'm sorry, Alan.
Well, thank you very much. It was a blow to our family.
I'm sure. I'm sorry.
But my son wanted to live, and he fought to live. But the hospital said that he was using too many of their resources, and they had a committee that met with my wife and myself, and they badgered us day after day, to let my son go. They didn't want to do any more treatment on him.
So not assisted suicide, but just remove the treatment.
In its own way, it was.
Yeah.
Because they just went around the corner, and they took my son's treatment away and his procedures away, and he died within 3 days, but he wanted to live. And we don't know tomorrow what type of cure would come for an illness that a patient has that wants to live. And if they're going to put him to death before they want to die or before they die of natural causes, they won't have a chance.
Alan, let me ask you, and I'm so sorry for your loss, but did they literally say your son is using too many resources?
Yes, they literally told my wife and I, and they also told us that he was their patient, that they didn't know
not your life to judge.
For him was correct.
Yeah. So what do you think about this law, though, for people? Your son wanted to live. There are others in different circumstances who do, maybe desperately do not, Alan.
But it's still wrong because people have been dying for as long as history has been in effect, and they haven't had the need of having a doctor assist them dying. You're perverting a doctor's sworn oath, and I think it's totally wrong, and I'm totally against it.
Alan, with deep respect and sympathy, I appreciate your call and we respect your loss. Let us look at this. Thank you, Alan, and I'm sorry for your family. Ed, there's kind of the slippery slope argument. Here's a young man who wanted to live, but it was expensive. You can see how Alan's looking at this as a father in a family that's taken a grievous loss.
I think we would want to know a little bit more about precisely what was going on there, whether there was any effective treatment that could be given or not. But again, this is a completely different issue than what we're talking
about.
But
it raises the prospect of a medical institution saying, you know what, this is too expensive, wouldn't you like to go?
And you'll notice that this has nothing to do with this law that we're proposing.
Well, nothing to do, but it opens
well,
that.
For-profit managed care where doctors are capitated, and hospitals are capitated.
That means you
given
can
a certain
spend
amount
so
of money,
much. Yeah.
And they have to make choices. And so there's pressures to suggest that spending more money on the ends of life, which is always going to cost you more money.
Right.
At the ends
there's
of
no
life.
Question. We would have to watch out for this. Do you think the law adequately safeguards against that creeping in, Ed?
Well, it certainly has in Oregon for 15 years.
Jessica, in Nashua, Iowa. Jessica, thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Yes.
I just wanted to say that I recently, for the last 3 years, I was a hospice chaplain for a major hospice and spent lots of time working with an interdisciplinary team of nurses, doctors, social workers, and like I said, I was a chaplain, so I was a spiritual care provider.
Yes.
And our whole goal was to do exactly kind of what we've been talking about, make persons with terminal diagnosis to help them have the easiest transition at the end of the life, to live until they die, all of those really wonderful, meaningful things.
But not an assisted death, not that, but to rather give them perfect care along the way.
We should always tell our patients, we don't delay your death, we don't hasten your death.
Okay.
We are here to help support things to happen naturally. However,
what did you learn in that, Jessica? What did you see?
Well, what I would say, and this is kind of, I was just calling in to say that I would say that there were a handful of patients for whom, despite having optimal spiritual care, optimal psychosocial care, mm-hmm. optimal symptom management, having all of the support, family, resources that any person could hope for at the end of their life, for them, the anxiety of the anticipation of their death was still more than they could handle. And I could easily count a significant amount of patients for whom, if this had been an option, they would have wanted it as part of their plan.
With your experience, then, Jessica, having seen that, would you support this? Let's say for Iowa.
I would absolutely, I certainly think that there's all kinds of parameters that need to be in place to ensure that it's not abused. I certainly think that the expectation of a terminal diagnosis is absolutely on point for that. But I would say that we were able to help meet the needs of so many patients for whom they never would have considered it.
Right. Jessica, we've got it. Our time is short. Michael, what does this say to your point? Optimal care along spectrum, and still you'd say no? Does that mean you've got something else that's driving your objection?
What I'd say is that that's a tragedy and sad, but I don't think we want to have legislation and open up the potential for this abuse.
Well, why, if it's the only legal way to help those people who would be up against Jessica's seen and experienced.
People can have adequate pain relief, that there should be no excuse for giving people the absolute amount of narcotics.
I mean, she said sometimes
death is hastened by giving appropriate narcotics to try to relieve pain and suffering. But I think that that's the difference between the intent of trying to kill somebody or helping kill. And by the way, the patient at the end of life may not be able to take the medicine themselves. There's nausea, there's vomiting, in which case it will lead to, I think, helping the person die.
Ed Lowenstein, this is coming right up. In this state, Massachusetts, where you guys are sitting, polls look like registered voters are favoring this pretty strongly. What's your expectation here?
Well, we are hopeful that this will pass. The support has been high. It's been very high. In candor, we are concerned about the TV ads, which have just started, which are misleading and are paid for by forces which are very much against this. So that's a concern.
The whole country will be watching. Ed Lowenstein with the Harvard Medical School, thank you very much for being with us. And Michael Grodin at Boston University School of Public Health. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.